Corvette. And the feelings just overwhelmed him. Norman didn't know if he was crying for Ted or crying for himself, because it was clear to him that one by one, they were all dying down here. He was very sad and very afraid. Beth was in D-cell at the communications console, turning on all the monitors. "They did a pretty good job with this place," she said. "Everything is marked. Everything has instructions. There are computer help files. An idiot could figure it out. There's just one problem that I can see."
"What's that?"
"The galley was an E-sill, and E-sill is flooded. We've got no food, Norman."
"None at all?"
"I don't think so."
"Water?"
"Yes, plenty of water, but no food."
"Well, we can make it without food. How much longer have we got down here?"
"It looks like 2 more days.
"We can make it," Norman said, thinking. 2 days, Jesus. 2 more days in this place.
"That's assuming the storm clears on schedule," Beth added. "I've been trying to figure out how to release a surface balloon and see what it's like up there. Tina used to punch some special code to release a balloon."
"We can make it," Norman said again.
"Oh, sure. If worst comes to worst, we can always get food from the spaceship. There's plenty over there."
"Do you think we can risk going outside?"
"We'll have to," she said, glancing at the screens. "Sometime in the next 3 hours."
"Why?"
"The mini-sub. It has that automatic surfacing timer. Unless someone goes over and punches the button."
"The hell with the sub," Norman said.
"Let the sub go."
"Well, don't be too hasty," Beth said.
"That sub can hold 3 people.
"You mean we could all get out of here in it?"
"Yeah, that's what I mean."
"Christ," Norman said. "Let's go now."
"There are 2 problems with that," Beth said. She pointed to the screens. "I've been going over the specs. First, the sub is unstable on the surface. If there are big waves on the surface, it'll bounce us around worse than anything we've had down here. And the second thing is that we have to link up with the decompression chamber on the surface. Don't forget, we still have 96 hours of decompression ahead of us."
"And if we don't decompress," Norman said. He was thinking, "Let's just go to the surface in the sub and throw open the hatch and see the clouds in the sky and breathe some normal Earth air."
"We have to decompress," Beth said. "Your bloodstream is saturated with helium gas in solution. Right now you're under pressure, so everything is fine. But if you release that pressure suddenly, it's just the same as when you pop the top off a soda bottle. The helium will bubble explosively out of your system. You'll die instantly."
"Oh," Norman said.
96 hours, Beth said. "That's how long it takes to get the helium out of you."
"Oh."
Norman went to the porthole and looked across at DH-7 and the mini-sub. It was 100 yards away.
"You think the squid will come back?"
She shrugged.
"Ask Jerry."
Norman thought, no more of that Geraldine stuff now. Or did she prefer to think of this malevolent entity as masculine? "Which monitor is it?"
"This one." She flicked it on. The screen glowed.
Norman said, "Jerry, are you there?"
No answer.
He typed, "Jerry, are you there?" There was no response.
"I'll tell you something about Jerry," Beth said. "He can't really read minds. When we were talking to him before, I sent him a thought and he didn't respond."
"I did too," Norman said. "I sent both messages and images. He never responded."
"If we speak, he answers. But if we just think, he doesn't answer," Beth said.
"So he's not all powerful. He actually behaves as if he hears us."
"That's right," Norman said. "Although he doesn't seem to be hearing us now."
"No, I tried earlier, too."
"I wonder why he isn't answering. You said he was emotional. Maybe he's sulking."
Norman didn't think so. Child kings didn't sulk. They were vindictive and whimsical, but they didn't sulk.
By the way, she said, you might want to look at these. She handed him a stack of printouts. They're the record of all the interactions we've had with him. They may give us a clue, Norman said, thumbing through the sheets without any real enthusiasm. He felt suddenly tired. Anyway, it'll occupy your mind. True. Personally, Beth said, I'd like to go back to the ship.
What for?
I'm not convinced we've found everything that's there.
It's a long way to the ship, Norman said.
I know, but if we get a clear time without the squid, I might try.
Just to occupy your mind?
I guess you could say that. She glanced at her watch. Norman, I'm going to get a couple of hours of sleep, she said. Then we can draw straws to see who goes to the submarine.
Okay.
You seem depressed, Norman.
I am.
Me too, she said. This place feels like a tomb, and I've been prematurely buried.
She climbed the ladder to her laboratory, but apparently she didn't go to sleep, because after a few moments he heard Tina's recorded voice on videotape saying,
Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?
And Beth replied, Maybe. I don't know.
It scares me.
The whir of rewinding and a short delay, then,
Do you think they'll ever get the sphere open?
Maybe. I don't know.
It scares me.
The tape was becoming an obsession with Beth. He stared at the printouts on his lap, and then he looked at the screen.
Jerry, he said, are you there?
Jerry did not answer. The sub. She was shaking his shoulder gently.
Norman opened his eyes.
It's time, Beth said.
Okay. He yawned. God, he was tired.
How much time is left?
Half an hour.
Beth switched on the sensory array at the communications console, adjusted the settings.
You know how to work all that stuff?
Norman said.
The sensors?
Pretty well. I've been learning it.
Then I should go to the sub, he said. He knew Beth would never agree that she would insist on doing the active thing, but he wanted to make the effort.
Okay, she said. You go. That makes sense.
He covered his surprise.
I think so, too.
Somebody has to watch the array, she said, and I can give you warning if the squid is coming.
Right, he said, thinking, hell, she's serious. I don't think this is one for Harry, Norman said.
No, Harry's not very physical, and he's still asleep. I say let him sleep.
Right, Norman said.
You'll need help with your suit, Beth said.
Oh, that's right, my suit, Norman said. The fan is broken in my suit.
Fletcher fixed it for you, Beth said.
I hope she did it right.
Maybe I should go instead, Beth said.
No, you watch the consoles. I'll go. It's only 100 yards or so anyway. It can't be a big deal.
All clear now, she said, glancing at the monitors.
Right, Norman said. His helmet clicked in place, and Beth tapped his faceplate, gave him a questioning look. Was everything all right?
Norman nodded, and she opened the floor hatch for him.
He waved goodbye and jumped into the chilly black water. On the sea floor, he stood beneath the hatch for a moment and waited to make sure he could hear his circulating fan. Then he moved out from beneath the habitat. There were only a few lights on in the habitat, and he could see many thin lines of bubbles streaming upward from the leaking cylinders.
How are you? Beth said over the intercom.
Okay. You know the place is leaking?
It looks worse than it is, Beth said. Trust me.
Norman came to the edge of the habitat and looked across the 100 yards of open seafloor that separated him from DH-7.
How does it look? Still clear?
Still clear, Beth said. Norman set out. He walked as quickly as he could, but he felt as if his feet were moving in slow motion. He was soon short of breath. He swore.
What's the matter?
I can't go fast. He kept looking north, expecting at any moment to see the greenish glow of the approaching squid, but the horizon remained dark.
You're doing fine, Norman. Still clear.
He was now 50 yards from the habitat, halfway there.
He could see DH-7, much smaller than their own habitat, a single cylinder 40 feet high with very few portholes. Alongside it was the inverted dome and the minisub.
"You're almost there," Beth said. "Good work."
Norman began to feel dizzy. He slowed his pace. He could now see markings on the gray surface of the habitat. There were all sorts of block-printed navy stencils.
"Coast is still clear," Beth said. "Congratulations. Looks like you made it."
He moved under the DH-7 cylinder, looked up at the hatch. It was closed. He spun the wheel, pushed it open. He couldn't see much of the interior because most of the lights were out. But he wanted to have a look inside. There might be something, some weapon they could use.
"Sub first," Beth said. "You've only got 10 minutes to push the button."
"Right." Norman moved to the sub. Standing behind the twin screws, he read the name. Deep Star 3. The sub was yellow, like the sub that he had ridden down, but its configuration was somewhat different. He found handholds on the side, pulled himself up into the pocket of air trapped inside the dome. There was a large acrylic bubble canopy on top of the sub for the pilot. Norman found the hatch behind, opened it, and dropped inside. "I'm in the sub." There was no answer from Beth. She probably couldn't hear him, surrounded by all this metal. He looked around the sub, thinking, "I'm dripping wet." But what was he supposed to do, wipe his shoes before entering? He smiled at the thought. He found the tapes secured in an aft compartment. There was plenty of room for more, and plenty of room for 3 people. But Beth was right about going to the surface. The interior of the sub was crammed with instruments and sharp edges. If you got banged around in here, it wouldn't be pleasant. Where was the delay button? He looked at the darkened instrument panel and saw a single flashing red light above a button marked Timer Hold. He pressed the button. The red light stopped flashing and now remained steadily on. A small amber video screen glowed. Timer reset, counting 12-0-0-0-0. As he watched, the numbers began to run backward. He must have done it, he thought. The video screen switched off. Still looking at all the instruments, a thought occurred to him. In an emergency, could he operate this sub? He slipped into the pilot's chair, faced the bewildering dials and switches of the instrument array. There didn't seem to be any steering apparatus, no wheel or joystick. How did you work the damn thing? The video screen switched on. Deep Star 3, command module. You require help? Yes. No. Cancel. Yes, he thought. I require help. He looked around for a yes button near the screen, but there wasn't any that he could see. Finally, he thought to touch the screen, pressing yes. Deep Star 3, checklist options. Descend. Ascend. Secure. Shut down. Monitor. Cancel. He pressed ascend. The screen changed to a small drawing of the instrument panel. One particular section of the drawing blinked on and off. Beneath the picture were the words, Deep Star 3 Ascend Checklist. 1. Set ballast blowers to on. Proceed to next. Cancel. So that was how it worked, Norman thought. A step-by-step checklist stored in the sub's computer. All you had to do was follow directions. He could do that. A small surge of current moved the sub, swaying it at its tether. He pressed the cancel, and the screen went blank. It flashed. Timer reset, counting 11:53:04. The counter was still running backward. He thought, have I really been here 7 minutes? Another surge of current, and the sub swayed again. It was time to go. He moved to the hatch, climbed out into the dome, and closed the hatch. He lowered himself down the side of the sub, touched the bottom. Out from beneath the shielding metal, his radio immediately crackled.
You there? Norman, are you there? Answer, please.
It was Harry on the radio.
I'm here, Norman said. Norman, for God's sake!
In that moment, Norman saw the greenish glow, and he knew why the sub had surged and rocked at its moorings. The squid was just 10 yards away, its glowing tentacles writhing out toward him, churning up the sediment along the ocean floor.
Norman, will you...
There was no time to think. Norman took 3 steps, jumped, and pulled himself through the open hatch into DH-7. He slammed the hatch door down behind him, but the flat, spade-like tentacle was already reaching in. He pinned the tentacle in the partially closed hatch, but the tentacle didn't withdraw. It was incredibly strong and muscular, writhing as he watched, the suckers like small puckered mouths opening and closing. Norman stomped down on the hatch, trying to force the tentacle to withdraw. With a muscular flip, the hatch flew open, knocking him backward, and the tentacle reached up into the habitat. He smelled the strong odor of ammonium. Norman fled, climbing higher into the cylinder. The second tentacle appeared, splashing up through the hatch. The two tentacles swung in circles beneath him, searching. He came to a portal and looked out, saw the great body of the animal, the huge, round, staring eye. He clambered higher, getting away from the tentacles. Most of the cylinder seemed to be given over to storage. It was crammed with equipment, boxes, tanks. Many of the boxes were bright red with stencils. Caution, no smoking, no electronics, TVAC explosives. There were a hell of a lot of explosives in here, he thought, stumbling upward. The tentacles rose higher behind him. Somewhere, in a detached, logical part of his brain, he thought, the cylinder is only 40 feet high, and the tentacles are at least 40 feet long. There will be no place for me to hide. He stumbled, banged his knee, kept going. He heard the slap of the tentacles as they struck the wall, swung upward toward him. A weapon, he thought. I have to find a weapon. He came to the small galley, metal counter, some pots and pans. He pulled the drawers open hastily, looking for a knife. He could find only a small paring knife, threw it away in disgust. He heard the tentacles coming closer. The next moment he was knocked down, his helmet banging on the deck. Norman scrambled to his feet, dodged the tentacle, moved up the cylinder. A communication section, radio set, computer, a couple of monitors. The tentacles were right behind him, slithering up like nightmarish vines. His eyes burned from the ammonia fumes. He came to the bunks, a narrow space near the top of the cylinder. No place to hide, he thought. No weapons, and no place to hide. The tentacles reached the top of the cylinder, slapped against the upper curved surface, swung sideways. In a moment they would have him. He grabbed the mattress from one bunk, held it up as flimsy protection. The two tentacles were swinging erratically around him. He dodged the first, and then with a whump, the second tentacle coiled around him, holding both him and the mattress in a cold, slimy grip. He felt a sickening slow squeeze, the dozens of suckers gripping his body, cutting into his skin. He moaned in horror. The second tentacle swung back to grip him along with the first. He was trapped in a vise. Oh, God, he thought. The tentacles swung away from the wall, lifting him high in the air, into the middle of the cylinder. This is it, he thought. But in the next moment he felt his body sliding downward past the mattress, and he slipped through the grip and fell through the air. He grabbed the tentacles for support, sliding down the giant, evil-smelling vines, and then he crashed down onto the deck near the galley, his head banging on the metal deck. He rolled onto his back. He saw the two tentacles above, gripping the mattress, squeezing it, twisting it. Did the squid realize what had happened, that he had gotten free? Norman looked around desperately. A weapon, a weapon. This was a Navy habitat. There must be a weapon somewhere. The tentacles tore the mattress apart. Shreds of white padding drifted down through the cylinder. The tentacles released the mattress, the big pieces falling. Then the tentacles started swinging around the habitat again, searching. It knows, he thought. It knows I have gotten away and that I am still in here somewhere. It is hunting me. But how did it know? Norman ducked behind the galley as one of the flat tentacles came crashing through the pots and pans, sweeping around, feeling for him. Norman scrambled back, coming up against a large potted plant. The tentacle was still searching, moving restlessly across the floor, banging the pans. Norman pushed the plant forward, and the tentacle gripped it, uprooted it easily, sweeping it away into the air. The distraction allowed Norman to scramble forward. A weapon, he thought. A weapon. He looked down to where the mattress had fallen, and he saw, lining the wall near the bottom hatch, a series of silver vertical bars. Spear guns! Somehow he had missed them on the way up. Each spear gun was tipped in a fat bulb, like a hand grenade. Explosive tips? He started to climb down. The tentacles were sliding down, too, following him. How did the squid know where he was? And then, as he passed a porthole, he saw the eye outside, and he thought, he can see me, for God's sake. Stay away from the portholes. Not thinking clearly,
Everything happening fast.
Crawling down past the explosive crates in the storage hold, thinking, I'd better not miss in here. And he landed with a clang on the airlock deck. The arms were slithering down, moving down the cylinder toward him. He tugged at one of the spear guns. It was strapped to the wall with a rubber cord. Norman pulled at it, tried to release it. The tentacles drew closer. He yanked at the rubber, but it wouldn't release. What was wrong with these snaps? The tentacles were closer, coming down swiftly. Then he realized the cords had safety catches. You had to pull the gun sideways, not out. He did. The rubber popped free. The spear gun was in his hand. He turned, and the tentacle knocked him down. He flipped onto his back and saw the great, flat, suckered palm of the tentacle coming straight down on him, and the tentacle wrapped over his helmet. Everything was black, and he fired. There was tremendous pain in his chest and abdomen. For a horrified moment, he thought he had shot himself. Then he gasped, and he realized it was just the concussion. His chest was burning, but the squid released him. He still couldn't see. He pulled the palm off his face, and it fell heavily onto the deck, writhing, severed from the squid arm. The interior walls of the habitat were spattered with blood. One tentacle was still moving. The other was a bloody, ragged stump. Both arms pulled out through the hatch, slipped into the water. Norman ran for the porthole. The squid moved swiftly away, the green glow diminishing. He had done it. He'd beaten it off. He'd done it.
DH-8.
How many did you bring?
Harry said, turning the spear gun over in his hands.
5, Norman said. That was all I could carry. But it worked?
He was examining the bulbous explosive tip.
Yeah, it worked. Blew the whole tentacle off.
I saw the squid going away, Harry said. I figured you must have done something.
Where's Beth?
I don't know. Her suit's gone. I think she may have gone to the ship.
Gone to the ship? Norman said, frowning.
All I know is when I woke up, she was gone. I figured you were over at the habitat, and then I saw the squid, and I tried to get you on the radio, but I guess the metal blocked the transmission.
Beth left? Norman said. He was starting to get angry. Beth was supposed to stay at the communications console, watching the sensors for him while he was outside. Instead, she had gone to the ship.
Her suit's gone, Harry said again.
Son of a bitch, Norman said. He was suddenly furious. Really, deeply furious. He kicked the console.
Careful there, Harry said.
Damn it. Take it easy, Harry said. Come on, take it easy, Norman.
What the hell does she think she's doing?
Come on, sit down, Norman. Harry steered him to a chair. We're all tired.
Damn right we're tired.
Easy, Norman, easy. Remember your blood pressure.
My blood pressure's fine.
Not now it's not, Harry said. You're purple.
How could she let me go outside and then just leave?
Worse, go out herself, Harry said.
But she wasn't watching out for me anymore,
Norman said. And then it came to him why he was so angry. He was angry because he was afraid. At a moment of great personal danger, Beth had abandoned him. There were only 3 of them left down there, and they needed each other. They needed to depend on each other. But Beth was unreliable, and that made him afraid and angry.
Can you hear me? Her voice said on the intercom. Anybody hear me?
Norman reached for the microphone, but Harry snatched it away.
I'll do this, he said.
Yes, Beth, we can hear you.
I'm in the ship, she said, her voice crackling on the intercom. I've found another compartment aft behind the crew bunks. It's quite interesting.
Quite interesting, Norman thought. Jesus, quite interesting. He grabbed the microphone from Harry.
Beth, what the hell are you doing over there?
Oh, hi, Norman. You made it back okay, huh?
Barely.
You have some trouble?
She didn't sound concerned.
Yes, I did.
Are you all right? You sound mad.
You bet I'm mad. Beth, why did you leave while I was out there?
Harry said he'd take over for me.
He what?
Norman looked at Harry. Harry was shaking his head no.
Harry said he'd take over at the console for me. He told me to go ahead to the ship. Since the squid wasn't around, it seemed like a good time.
Norman cupped his hands over the microphone. I don't remember that, Harry said.
Did you talk to her?
I don't remember talking to her.
Beth said,
just ask him, Norman. He'll tell you.
He says he never said that.
Well, then he's full of it,
Beth said.
What do you think? I'd abandon you when you were outside, for Christ's sake?
There was a pause. I'd never do that, Norman.
I swear, Harry said to Norman, I never had any conversation with Beth. I never talked to her at all.
I'm telling you, she was gone when I woke up.
There was nobody here. If you ask me, she always intended to go to the ship.
Norman remembered how quickly Beth had agreed to let Norman go to the sub, how surprised he had been. Perhaps Harry was right, he thought. Perhaps Beth had been planning it all along.
You know what I think?
Harry said. I think she's cracking up.
Over the intercom, Beth said, You guys get it straightened out?
Norman said, I think so, Beth. Yes.
Good, Beth said. Because I have made a discovery over here in the spaceship.
What's that?
I've found the crew.
You both came, Beth said. She was sitting on a console in the comfortable beige flight deck of the spacecraft.
Yes,
Norman said, looking at her. She looked okay. If anything, she looked better than ever, stronger, clearer. She actually looked rather beautiful, he thought.
Harry thought that the squid wouldn't come back.
The squid was out there? Norman briefly told her about his attack.
Jesus! I'm sorry, Norman. I'd never have left if I had any idea.
She certainly didn't sound like somebody who was cracking up, Norman thought. She sounded appropriate and sincere.
Anyway, he said, I injured it and Harry thought it wouldn't come back.
Harry said, and we couldn't decide who should stay behind, so we both came.
Well, come this way, Beth said.
She led them back, through the crew quarters, past the 20 bunks for the crew, the large galley.
Norman paused at the galley.
So did Harry.
I'm hungry, Harry said.
Eat something, Beth said.
I did. They have some sort of nut bars or something. They taste okay.
She opened a drawer in the galley, produced bars wrapped in metal foil, gave them each one. Norman tore the foil and saw something that looked like chocolate. It tasted dry.
Anything to drink?
Sure. She threw open a refrigerator door.
Diet Coke?
You're kidding. The can design is different, and I'm afraid it's warm, but it's Diet Coke, all right.
I'm buying stock in that company, Harry said. Now that we know it'll still be there in 50 years.
He read the can.
Official drink of the Star Voyager expedition.
Yeah, it's a promo, Beth said. Harry turned the can around. The other side was printed in Japanese.
Wonder what this means.
It means don't buy that stock after all, she said. Norman sipped the Coke with a sense of vague unease. The galley seemed subtly changed from the last time he had seen it. He wasn't sure. He'd only glanced briefly at the room before, but he usually had a good memory for room layouts, and his wife had always joked that Norman could find his way around any kitchen. You know, he said, I don't remember a refrigerator in the galley.
I never really noticed myself, Beth said.
As a matter of fact, Norman said, this whole room looks different to me. It looks bigger and, I don't know, different.
It's because you're hungry, Harry grinned.
Maybe, Norman said. Harry could actually be right. In the 60s, there had been a number of studies of visual perception, which demonstrated that subjects interpreted blurred slides according to their predispositions. Hungry people saw all the slides as food. But this room really did look different. For instance, he didn't remember the door to the galley being to the left, as it was now. He remembered it as being in the center of the wall separating the galley from the bunks.
This way, Beth said, leading them farther aft.
Actually, the refrigerator was what got me thinking. It's one thing to store a lot of food on a test ship being sent through a black hole, but to stock a refrigerator, why bother to do that? It made me think there might be a crew after all.
They entered a short, glass-walled tunnel. Deep purple lights glowed down on them.
Ultraviolet, Beth said. I don't know what it's for.
Disinfection?
Maybe.
Maybe it's to get a suntan, Harry said. Vitamin D.
Then they came into a large room, unlike anything Norman had ever seen. The floor glowed purple, bathing the room in ultraviolet light from beneath. Mounted on all four walls were a series of wide glass tubes. Inside each tube was a narrow silver mattress. The tubes all appeared empty. "Over here," Beth said. They peered through one glass tube. The naked woman had once been beautiful. It was still possible to see that. Her skin was dark brown and deeply wrinkled. Her body withered. "Mummified?" Harry said. Beth nodded. "Best I can figure out. I haven't opened the tube, considering the risk of infection." "What was this room?" he said, looking around. "It must be some kind of hibernation chamber. Each tube is separately connected to a life support system, power supply, air handlers, heaters, the works, in the next room." Harry counted. 20 tubes, he said.
"And 20 bunks," Norman said.
"So where is everybody else?"
Beth shook her head.
"I don't know." "This woman is the only one left?"
"Looks like it.
I haven't found any others."
"I wonder how they all died," Harry said.
"Have you been to the sphere?" Norman asked Beth.
"No, why?"
"Just wondered."
"You mean you wondered if the crew died after they picked up the sphere?"
"Basically, yes."
"I don't think the sphere is aggressive or dangerous in any sense," Beth said. "It's possible that the crew died of natural causes in the course of the journey itself. This woman, for example, is so well preserved it makes you wonder about radiation. Maybe she got a large dose of radiation. There's tremendous radiation around a black hole."
"You think the crew died going through the black hole, and the sphere was picked up automatically by the spacecraft later?"
"It's possible."
"She's pretty good looking," Harry said, peering through the glass. "Boy, the reporters would go crazy with this, wouldn't they? Sexy woman from the future found nude and mummified. Film at 11.
"She's tall, too," Norman said. "She must be over 6 feet.
"An Amazon woman," Harry said, "with great tits."
"All right," Beth said.
"What's wrong? Offended on her behalf?" Harry said. "I don't think there's any need for comments of that kind."
"Actually, Beth," Harry said, "she looks a little like you." Beth frowned.
"I'm serious. Have you looked at her?"
"Don't be ridiculous." Norman peered through the glass, shielding his hand against the reflection of the purple UV tubes in the floor. The mummified woman did indeed look like Beth. Younger, taller, stronger, but like Beth, nevertheless.
"He's right," Norman said. "Maybe she's you from the future," Harry said.
"No, she's obviously in her 20s.
"Maybe she's your granddaughter."
"Pretty unlikely," Beth said.
"You never know," Harry said. "Does Jennifer look like you?"
"Not really, but she's at that awkward stage, and she doesn't look like that woman, and neither do I."
Norman was struck by the conviction with which Beth denied any resemblance or association to the mummified woman. "Beth," he said, "what do you suppose happened here? Why is this woman the only one left?"
"I think she was important to the expedition," Beth said.
"Maybe even the captain or the co-captain. The others were mostly men. And they did something foolish, I don't know what, something she advised them against, and as a result they all died. She alone remained alive in this spacecraft, and she piloted it home. But there was something wrong with her, something she couldn't help, and she died."
"What was wrong with her?"
"I don't know, something."
Fascinating, Norman thought. He'd never really considered it before, but this room, for that matter, this entire spacecraft, was one big Rorschach. Or, more accurately, a TAT, the thematic apperception test, was a psychological test that consisted of a series of ambiguous pictures. Subjects were supposed to tell what they thought was happening in the pictures. Since no clear story was implied to the pictures, the subjects supplied the stories. And the stories told much more about the storytellers than about the pictures. Now Beth was telling them her fantasy about this room. That a woman had been in charge of the expedition, the men had failed to listen to her, they had died, and she alone had remained alive, the sole survivor. It didn't tell them much about this spaceship, but it told them a lot about Beth.
"I get it," Harry said. You mean she's the one who made the mistake and piloted the ship back too far into the past? Typical woman driver.
Do you have to make a joke of everything?
Do you have to take everything so seriously?
This is serious, Beth said.
I'll tell you a different story, Harry said. This woman screwed up. She was supposed to do something, and she forgot to do it, or else she made a mistake. And then she went into hibernation. As a result of her mistake, the rest of the crew died, and she never woke up from the hibernation, never realized what she had done, because she was so unaware of what was really happening.
I'm sure you like that story better, Beth said. It fits with your typical black male contempt for women.
Easy, Norman said.
You resent the power of the female, Beth said.
What power? You call lifting weights power? That's only strength, and it comes out of a feeling of weakness, not power.
You skinny little weasel, Beth said.
What are you going to do, beat me up? Harry said. Is that your idea of power?
I know what power is, Beth said, glaring at him.
Easy, easy, Norman said. Let's not get into this.
Harry said, what do you think, Norman? Do you have a story about the room, too?
No, Norman said, I don't.
Oh, come on, Harry said. I bet you do.
No, Norman said. And I'm not going to mediate between you two. We've all got to stay together on this. We have to work as a team as long as we're down here.
It's Harry who's divisive, Beth said. From the beginning of this trip, he's tried to make trouble with everybody. All those snide little comments.
What snide little comments? Harry said.
You know perfectly well what snide little comments, Beth said.
Norman walked out of the room.
Where are you going?
Your audience is leaving.
Why?
Because you're both boring.
Oh, Beth said. Mr. Cool Psychologist decides we are boring?
That's right, Norman said, walking through the glass tunnel, not looking back.
Where do you get off making all these judgments of other people?
Beth shouted at him.
He kept walking.
I'm speaking to you. Don't you walk away while I'm speaking to you, Norman.
He came into the galley once more and started opening the drawers, looking for the nut bars. He was hungry again, and the search took his mind off the other two. He had to admit he was disturbed by the way things were going. He found a bar, tore the foil, ate it. Disturbed, but not surprised. In studies of group dynamics, he had long ago verified the truth of the old statement, three is a crowd. For a high-tension situation, groups of three were inherently unstable. Unless everybody had clearly defined responsibilities, the group tended to form shifting allegiances, two against one. That was what was happening now. He finished the nut bar and immediately ate another one. How much longer did they have down here? At least 36 hours more. He looked for a place to carry additional nut bars, but his polyester jumpsuit had no pockets. Beth and Harry came into the galley, much chagrined.
Want a nut bar? He said, chewing.
We want to apologize, she said.
For what?
For acting like children, Harry said.
I'm embarrassed, Beth said. I feel terrible about losing my temper that way. I feel like a complete idiot.
Beth was hanging her head, staring at the floor.
Interesting how she flipped, he thought, from aggressive self-confidence to the complete opposite, abject self-apology.
Nothing in between.
Let's not take it too far, he said. We're all tired.
I feel just awful, Beth continued.
Really awful.
I feel as if I've let you both down. I shouldn't be here in the first place. I'm not worthy to be in this group.
Norman said, Beth, have a nut bar and stop feeling sorry for yourself.
Yes, Harry said. I think I like you better angry.
I'm sick of those nut bars, Beth said. Before you came here, I ate 11 of them.
Well, make it an even dozen, Norman said, and we'll go back to the habitat. Walking back across the ocean floor, they were tense, watching for the squid. But Norman derived comfort from the fact that they were armed. And something else, some inner confidence that came from his earlier confrontation with the squid.
You hold that spear gun like you mean it, Beth said.
Yes, I guess so.
All his life he had been an academic, a university researcher, and had never conceived of himself as a man of action, at least nothing beyond the occasional game of golf. Now, holding the spear gun ready, he found he rather liked the feeling. As he walked, he noticed the profusion of sea fans on the path between the spacecraft and the habitat. They were obliged to walk around the fans, which were sometimes 4 and 5 feet tall, gaudy purple and blue in their lights. Norman was quite sure that the fans had not been down here when they first arrived at the habitat. Now there were not only colorful fans, but schools of large fish, too. Most of the fish were black, with a reddish stripe across the back. Beth said they were Pacific surgeon fish, normal for the region. Everything is changing, he thought. It's all changing around us. But he wasn't sure about that. He didn't really trust his memory down here. There were too many other things to alter his perceptions. The high-pressure atmosphere, the injuries he had received, and the nagging tension and fear he lived with. Something pale caught his eye. Shining his light down on the bottom, he saw a wriggling white streak with a long thin fin and black stripes. At first he thought it was an eel. Then he saw the tiny head, the mouth. "Just wait," Beth said, putting her arm on him. "What is it?" "Sea snake." "Are they dangerous?" "Not usually." "Poisonous?" Harry said. "Very poisonous." The snake stayed close to the bottom, apparently looking for food. The snake ignored them entirely, and Norman found it quite beautiful to watch, particularly as it moved farther away. "It gives me the creeps," Beth said. "Do you know what kind it is?" Norman said. "It may be a belcher's," Beth said. "Pacific sea snakes are all poisonous, but belcher sea snake is the most poisonous. In fact, some researchers think it's the deadliest reptile in the world, with venom 100 times more powerful than the venom of a king cobra or the black tiger snake." "So if it bit you..." 2 minutes, tops." They watched the snake slither away among the fans. Then it was gone. "Sea snakes are not usually aggressive," Beth said. "Some divers even touch them, play with them, but I never would. God, snakes! Why are they so poisonous? Is it for immobilizing prey?" "You know, it's interesting," Beth said, "but the most toxic creatures in the world are all water creatures. The venom of land animals is nothing in comparison. And even among land animals, the most deadly poison is derived from an amphibian, a toad, Bufotenae marfensis. In the sea, there are poisonous fish, like the blowfish, which is a delicacy in Japan. There are poisonous shells, like the star cone, Alavertus lutensis. Once I was on a boat in Guam, and a woman brought up a star cone. The shells are very beautiful, but she didn't know you have to keep your fingers away from the point. The animal extruded its poison spine and stung her in the palm. She took 3 steps before she collapsed in convulsions, and she died within an hour. There are also poisonous plants, poisonous sponges, poisonous corals, and then the snakes. Even the weakest of the sea snakes are invariably lethal." "Nice," Harry said. "Well, you have to recognize that the ocean is a much older living environment than the land. There's been life in the oceans for 3.5 billion years, much longer than on land. The methods of competition and defense are much more highly developed in the ocean. There's been more time." "You mean a few 1 billion years from now, there will be tremendously poisonous animals on land, too?"
"If we get that far," she said.
"Let's just get back to the habitat," Harry said. The habitat was now very close. They could see all the streaming bubbles rising from the leaks. "Leaking like a bastard," Harry said. "I think we've got enough air. I think I'll check."
"Be my guest," Beth said, "but I did a thorough job." Norman thought another argument was about to start, but Beth and Harry dropped it. They came to the hatch and climbed up into DH-8. The console. "Jerry?" Norman stared at the console screen. It remained blank, just a blinking cursor. "Jerry, are you there?" The screen was blank. "I wonder why we aren't hearing from you, Jerry,"
Norman said. The screen remained blank.
Trying a little psychology?
Beth said. She was checking the controls for the external sensors, reviewing the graphs. If you ask me, the person you should use your psychology on is Harry.
What do you mean?
What I mean is, I don't think Harry should be screwing around with our life support systems. I don't...